Hello and welcome back to MEC Connect. This is Matthew Yaling and Patty Reinecke. We're joined today by Dr. Fernando Branco, Midwest Employers Casualty's Chief Medical Officer, and he's going to talk about CRIPS and RSD, and you'll have to stay tuned and see what he says about those two diagnoses.
Welcome, everybody. I know before I came here to Midwest, those incidents of CRIPS and RSD were very few and far between. So here in the excess world, we do see them a little bit more often.
Thank you, Fernando, for being here.
Well, hello, Patty. Hello, Matt. Thanks for inviting me, and I'm ready for your questions.
Well, I guess the first question, and Patty kind of alluded to it already, is do we really see claims that originated as a sprain or a strain morph into CRIPS, RSD in the excess world?
Yes, absolutely. It's quite common that this kind of cases start as a minor injury. Not necessarily all of them. Some of them will be a major injury, let's say a fracture or very heavy traumatic event, but they also be just some initial minimal musculoskeletal injury that progresses into this very complex, that is, it's beyond the disease, a syndrome. And it is quite often seen in our patients because we have the worst cases and cases that progress, let's say, in the wrong direction, that most initial injuries after some standard treatment of physical therapy, some imaging studies, rest, anti-inflammatories, most of the injuries, they get resolved on their own, and some progressed into more chronic conditions. And from these chronic conditions to got to the level of an excess carrier, you have to really have a lot of complications. But in terms of how often this happens, it happens often enough and is becoming more and more often that we see this cases for several reasons. I think when I was in medical school in the early 80s, we hardly ever talked about this. I don't even remember even being mentioned in medical school, chronic regional pain syndrome, or at the time was called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. I learned about this during my residency in the late 80s. In physical medicine and rehabilitation. And what it shows to you is that in general, this develops in a few weeks to months after an initial injury, be a strain or a sprain. But sometimes, unfortunately, now, because there is this very, very common awareness of all physicians about chronic regional pain syndrome, and it has become quite common of a diagnosis compared like we used to be. The most important thing in terms of this, I think some of these cases that start with sprain or strain, it is my personal experience. And again, this is not from a book or from a statistical analysis. It's from my anecdotal practice. And considering that I used to be considered before my previous life an expert on this diagnosis, and I used to get patients not only from locally at the time in Florida, but from all over the country to be evaluated for CRPS. And it's my experience that 90% of the patients that I evaluated and used the correct criteria to determine if it is complex regional pain syndrome or not, 90% actually did not have chronic regional pain syndrome. And having this diagnosis can be quite a taxing thing for the individual or for anybody that's treating or paying for the treatment.
Thank you. So along that same note, can you talk about complex regional pain syndrome, which I believe was formerly known as reflex sympathetic dystrophy, but now it's the complex regional pain syndrome. Can you tell us what it actually is?
That is a very interesting question. It's important because I'm old enough to know this history from the beginning. I know reflex sympathetic dystrophy, that's how it was known until, I believe, 20 to 25 years ago, and when then was decided, in my opinion, in a very somewhat controversial way to change this. I feel like a reflex sympathetic dystrophy simplifies and explains the condition better for people in general than complex regional pain syndrome. It's kind of a vague title for this disease. The reason they changed to complex regional pain syndrome is that they felt that it did not encompass certain types of reflex sympathetic dystrophy that were related to one single nerve injury. Let's say you had an ulnar nerve and the distribution of this nerve had sympathetic signs. then that wouldn't be included in reflex and sympathetic dystrophy. They wanted to separate and separate in complex regional pain syndrome 1 and complex regional pain syndrome 2. A complex regional pain syndrome is the one that we most of us know. It's like a limb that covers the whole limb. It's not following any pattern of one nerve. And then you have complex regional pain syndrome type 2 that follows our ulnar nerve or a medium nerve just on the area of that nerve. Very rare complex regional pain syndrome type 2. Over 90% of real complex regional pain syndrome will be type 1. That will be that mostly like a limb or a piece or a part of a limb, you know, a hand or a foot or the whole leg. Sometimes it varies. That means those are the important things to separate. But obviously, I don't have a problem with reflex sympathetic dystrophy because what it is the sympathetic system is going wild, like it's on fire. And if you want, you can go and Google sympathetic system and everything that does. And then you realize some of the symptoms like temperature changes, sweating, pain, all those things can be somewhat regulated by the sympathetic system. In consequence of that, we're going to be swelling, difficulty moving, muscle spasm. I mean, things that come out of this short circuit of the sympathetic system. That's why I like reflex sympathetic dystrophy, but we should not be using it anymore, unfortunately. But you're still going to hear this. You know, a lot of times people ask you a question and they say, what do you think about RSD? And for me, it's the same. And I just answer as being part of the syndrome, because why bother to have all this explanation, you know, going on?
Right. That's a lot of information there and very good information. And I'm just pulling out a couple of things. You mentioned earlier that the diagnosis was generally incorrect about 90% of the time, and that it's a difficult diagnosis to make in the first place. And we see it a little earlier now than we used to in the history. So how is the diagnosis made?
As I said, I was considered, you know, I still am, obviously. I didn't stop having the skills, but I'm just not practicing on a regular basis as an expert in complex regional pain syndrome. And to do that, you need to have had, obviously, a lot of experience, seeing a lot of cases, and also following the guidelines that are set up to diagnose complex regional pain syndrome. They are out there, and they're very clear. They're done by the International Pain Society. And if you follow them, you end up reducing in large number the number of diagnoses you're going to have. And that is, to start up, the most important thing. What's the most important tool for diagnosis? A good physical exam. And why is that a problem? Because as we know, physicians examined less and less the patients. It's just the way medicine is. Too busy, one patient in and out, rely a lot on the imaging studies. I'll talk a little bit about some of the diagnostic tools that you can use. But number one will be physical exam, because that's when you're going to see the different symptoms and signs that are typical of this disease. And you have to have the experience of have seen this and be able to differentiate between pain that's compatible with this injury or this is pain that's not compatible with this injury. And that will lead you towards, just on that specific piece, leads you in towards the direction of complex regional pain syndrome. As I said, I saw literally thousands of patients. And when you actually start seeing the real complex regional pain syndrome patients, it becomes very clear to you that most of this are just, they look like they are, but they really are not. Another ways that we can use, you know, and physicians should be using, there are ways like in the office, you can do temperature measurements. They have to be standardized. That means it can be like, for example, it's very common. I remember I was doing my residency and I was in Wisconsin and it would be minus 20 outside and the patient would come in. And sometimes patients have a difficult time putting a tight shoe on and they will be coming from the outside and they'll be in the office and I'll see the doctors coming over and touching the now. Both legs are exposed, and they go and touch the leg that it was covered with 5 socks and a shoe, and the other one that had 2 socks, and it was cold. Of course it was cold. You know, it's 20 degrees outside. That means you can't do that. You're going to have to keep a very standard system, let both legs stay in the same climate control environment, then measure the temperature. You need to have at least 1 degree centigrade different between the two. Which physician really does that? You know, that tells you that quite often they don't even bother with this. The most they're going to do is touch the leg and say, oh, it's cold. Okay, one more sign. And also you can do a sweat test. That's even more complex. A lot of physicians don't have this in their offices. But when you look at the leg doing your physical exam, you're going to notice the condition of the skin, the condition of the hair, the condition of the nails. All of this will give you a hint if this is complex regional pain syndrome or not. I've seen numerous times, this 90% is that they had none of this, and they were called complex regional pain syndrome because this person had what it seemed to be more pain than what should be for the type of injury that they had. That is not complex regional pain syndrome because it did not have all these other components. And why is that important? Because unfortunately, this diagnosis carries a huge burden with it, because as you know, the moment you say complex regional pain syndrome, the patients today, they go on the internet and they start reading. And of course, they're going to see, you know, horrendous pictures of the worst types of complex regional pain syndromes, that the patients are, you know, in really bad shape, and start telling you that there's an incurable condition and there's no treatment available. Basically, that's what you would find if you do a quick search. And it creates this disability conviction on that person right away. And that's one of the things that I fought a lot about, is to not label people complex regional pain syndrome. Even the name, you ask the patient and say, well, what do you have? And it goes, well, I have CREPS. That means CREPS is complex regional pain syndrome. That means you're a cripple. That's the feeling that you get. And that's one of the reasons that I definitely want to make sure that when you give the diagnosis, you give the right diagnosis to help this person. Continue with this after you finish your physical exam, do your temperature check, maybe some sweat testing. There are other tests that you can do. And in general, doctors do, but they're not the most accurate. For example, bone scans, that they're used quite often. And then it says, oh, look, the bone scan is positive. Well, bone scans are positive for all sorts of reasons, for osteoarthritis, some other trauma, and you can have a positive bone scan. If you have a negative bone scan, that might be a good sign that this is not complex regional pain syndrome. That means you can rule out, but you can't rule in with a bone scan. But it's a cheap test. Why not use it? Because then you can rule out a lot of these cases. Another way is x-rays. It's a cheap way to do it, but it's pretty much useless with complex regional pain syndrome. To have the bone to become osteopenic, you're going to have this condition for years and years, and that's not going to be normally what you're going to find on these cases. That means I wouldn't think about x-rays in general. My strongest suggestion that is something that will be used for diagnosis and also for treatment, it's the sympathetic blocks. And in general, if they're done correctly by a good interventional physician, they will go into the right at the node, the sympathetic node. And if the person responds to this, even if it's like 2 or 3 months, you pretty much make the diagnosis that this is complex regional pain syndrome. Unfortunately, what you see is people do 3, 4 sympathetic blocks and no response, and they say, oh, this is complex regional pain syndrome. That is not true. If you don't respond to sympathetic block, you don't have complex regional pain syndrome. This is a diagnostic and a treatment tool. We can talk a little bit more about treatment.
Yeah, that would be great. I know there's a lot that goes into the actual diagnosis, it sounds like, between the physical exam and the testing that correlates with it. But once you do get to that 10% of the cases that actually are showing all those signs of true complex regional pain syndrome, are there interventions or treatments that are effective treating and managing that kind of syndrome?
Yes, absolutely. In that regard, even with the diagnosis piece, I might have sounded like it was a lot to be done, but at the same time, it's actually fairly simple if you have the right experience. That's why it can be just everybody to be making this the evaluation and the diagnosis of these patients. You need to be very experienced. That means I think the difficulty is to find experienced people in real complex regional pain syndrome. And then with the treatment, as I said, the first line of treatment is the sympathetic block. And in general, that can be an excellent way if you respond, even if it's a short period of time, let's say 2 months or 3 months of improvement. And I'm sure some of you are saying, what do you mean short term? You know, the sympathetic blocks that I recommended, they help for like a week, and the doctor said it was a huge success. That is not, because a week of improvement, it's not a huge success. The only way you can call it a successful sympathetic block, and it actually shows that this is a complex regional pain syndrome, is at least 2 to 3 months, because then during that period, you go to the next most important piece that is very aggressive. When I say aggressive, it's not like do something to damage the patient. Because, by the way, physical therapists cannot damage any patients. If you ever guess in your mind that they cause herniations or they hurt patients, I have worked with physical therapists now close to 40 years, and I've never seen a single physical therapist damage a patient. That's why, you know, sometimes when doctors say, oh, you know, my surgery was great, then that therapist did something in your back and he broke my screws. That is not really possible. What problem was, or you had bad screws, or you placed the screws incorrectly, because therapists can't really do that. They're not a Superman. They just are doing what they need to do. But when I talk about aggressive, it's something that has to be intensive, has to be hands-on, because the technique that we use is called desensitization, and is a technique that's very counterintuitive, because what these patients are in general, they don't let you even get close to them, where the area that has pain, even the ones that are not real complex regional pain syndrome, if you have a lot of pain, you learn to not let anybody get close, because you don't want somebody by mistake to bump in your very painful limb, even if it's not complex regional. But with complex regional, it's even worse, because if they go under an air conditioning duct, they start almost screaming because that bothers them so much. Even the wind can be horrendous. But then what do you have to do? The therapist has to go there and do what we call desensitization techniques. Go there and puts his hands into this area that's very painful, that will cause pain, and that would be counterintuitive. But that start breaking some of the circuit of a continuous sympathetic discharge, and that's what's called desensitization. Will cause some pain. There's tons of ways to do that. And one of them, patients that don't put the foot down, you start saying, you're going to have to put your foot down. Let's do it. And it's painful, but we'll get better. That is the next step. Obviously, because this condition, by the time these patients are quite disabled, that means to reverse this, we're going to have to really work on a mind and body process. And that's why we recommend definitely some cognitive behavior therapy or CBT, not psychotherapy and long-term discussion of your depression. You know, it's CBT. It's give tools how to handle pain, how to handle the feelings of disability conviction and medication conviction. Those things have to be worked with your CBT professional. They're not necessarily needs to be a psychologist. They might be a social worker that's trained or even other professions. I've seen nurses also that have done a very good job with CBT. Those are very important. And of course, a few things that you can use, definitely not narcotics. I'm glad that today we don't even have to talk so much about this, because the paradigm has shifted so greatly that I think everybody now understands that narcotics are not good for any chronic pain, and much less for complex regional pain syndrome. Something that 20 years ago, I used to have tomatoes thrown at me when I said that in conferences, and people challenging me and saying, how dare you to say that? All my patients are happy on narcotics. But anyway, we don't use narcotics, but you can use certain medications. There are simple medications like clonidine. That is it's a medication that reduces sympathetic discharges that can be very helpful with a complex regional pain syndrome, or some anti-inflammatory, some simple pain medications. And I'm not going to go into all the antidepressants and all of those. In general, they're more like a help, not a treatment in itself. There is no such a thing as a nice pill that's going to fix this. It's going to be hard work from the patient, from the therapists, and from the team in general. That's the only way that these things get better. The earlier you start, the better, because you start reversing this process as early as possible. That's why a good diagnosis that doesn't label somebody when it isn't, but then identifies early that this is going in direction of CRPS. And then I'm sure some of you are asking, well, what's going on? Why is it that some people develop this? That we don't know. That would be like 1 in 100 that they'll develop CRPS with the same injury. It's probably there is genetic tendencies. There's probably something that you are predisposed to develop this. And we never know, because that's one of the reasons when you have somebody that has a minor injury and develops CRPS, and then we have another one that has multi-trauma and never develops. That's not very different. Like if you ever taken care of spinal cord injuries or brain injury patients, some develop these ossifications all over their bodies. That's called heterotopic ossification, and some don't develop. It has to do with the injury, of course. But the development of it has more to do with your own tendency to develop that you're not going to know. Our bodies are a mystery. You know, we are still just scratching the surface of our DNA. There is a tendency, no doubt about this. I am not going to go into the crazy treatments, as I call, like spinal cord stimulators, ketamine injections, ketamine inhalers or infusions. Spinal cord stimulators may be in very, very, very rare conditions, and you have to have a very good system. Maybe there'll be a recommendation in there, but those are not to be used on a regular basis.
So you've mentioned a lot of different professionals and doctors in that treatment. Maybe just outline who makes up the team.
Yes. Even before the interdisciplinary team, the people that will make the initial diagnosis will be the different types of physicians. Then we'll have, you know, a lot of times an orthopedic surgeon will see the patient, a neurosurgeon, then a neurologist, then a PM&R doctor. And then they start seeing this, they might recommend an interventional physician that does procedures, and most of them are anesthesiologists or PM&R doctors. They're the ones that in general train. Some neurologists also do some intervention, but the vast majority are anesthesiologists. That means I would say a neurosurgeon and orthopedic surgeon are probably not the best to make this diagnosis, number one, because that early on, it's never complex regional pain syndrome. I have had patients that got diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome in an emergency room. That's an absurdity, and it happens quite often. Or 2 weeks later, they already say they have complex regional pain syndrome. And a lot of times, this is like a cop-out of the doctors because they don't know what else to do. This patient didn't get better with the surgery, continues to complain. There's all these issues. Says, you know what? I think maybe you have complex regional pain syndrome. I'm going to send you to the pain doctor or the anesthesiologist or the PM&R. I think the best people to do an evaluation, if there is any doubt, will be a neurologist, a PM&R doctor. They have experience with complex regional pain syndrome, even avoiding maybe the anesthesiologist. Even so, I have amazingly good anesthesiologist friends. They're interventionist physicians, but they're not trained to do that kind of physical exam. They're trained to do the intervention. That means I would say neurologists and PM&Rs to start. And both actually run interdisciplinary groups in general. They will be involved with physical therapist, with an occupational therapist, and most of the time, you're going to have a psychologist or a social worker that would do the cognitive behavior therapy. You might have others involved, like a massage therapist, an acupuncturist. Those are all, some places will have that as an adjunct treatment. But in general, the most important one will be the physical therapist, the hands-on desensitization. And that can be done with just one person. But if you have a team, that's even better. That doesn't mean that other doctors can't make this diagnosis. I think, as I keep repeating over and over, it's all about experience. How many cases have you really followed? And unfortunately, what you see sometimes is people say, oh, I'm a specialist in CRPS, because in reality, they're a specialist in ketamine because they know how to do ketamine and they want to do ketamine. They say, I'm a CRPS specialist because I put everybody on ketamine. No, you're not. But that will be the short on this.
Thank you. That is great information. And I know that when we see complex regional pain syndrome on our claims here in the excess world, it is one of the most confusing and difficult claims we have. And I think you really hit upon all the different areas that need to be treated on the individual to make sure that that treatment is effective. I love the points too about being a specialist and having that experience, because you're right. Unless you see this and treat this and you're able to vary your treatment based on that individual, that would make a huge impact on the outcomes of those injured employees as well.
So, Fernando, you've been doing this for over 30 years. Can you give an example of how you've helped an injured employee with the difficult diagnosis of complex regional pain syndrome?
Yeah, because complex regional pain syndrome, if it's really complex regional pain syndrome, it's a very difficult diagnosis to treat. Sometimes it's very hard to get to the point that this person will be pain-free. But always the goal is to have an improvement of life quality. And I think that always is a goal and it's achievable to everybody. I think the most important intervention was to try to remove the label of this 90% that didn't have complex regional pain syndrome, because it is quite a burden. It's like, you know, somebody comes to you and say, you have cancer. I have seen this before because, for example, we all know now it becomes a very common. Everybody talks about skin cancer, right? And there is a difference between somebody coming to you and says you have a glioblastoma in your brain and you have a squamous cell carcinoma in your skin. There is a huge difference. But unfortunately, for most people, when you say cancer, it's cancer. And I think when you say complex regional pain syndrome, it's pretty taxing, and it's going to create all this expectation that my life is over and this is going to be forever. I'm a complete disabled person. And I think this 90%, all these people that I was able to get them out of this wheel of never-ending treatment, but there were definitely some very good treatments. You know, a young woman that came to me, and she was on a wheelchair. She was 26 years old. She had a spinal cord stimulator at full speed, and her legs were shaking the whole time. And after we did the whole process, desensitization, number one, she didn't have complex regional pain syndrome. She's been misdiagnosed for several years. We were able to remove the spinal cord stimulator. She were able to walk. She were able to have kids, that she couldn't do any of that until then. But in this case, was not complex regional pain syndrome. But it is a success story because you get it out. But I had real complex regional pain syndrome, some that are very successful. I think I had one kid, he was a musician, and he developed this horrible complex regional pain syndrome in his left lower extremity. And that was one of the few cases ever that I recommend, because we tried everything and it didn't work. And finally, we tried a spinal cord stimulator, and it gave him complete relief. And during that period, that's the time you're going to do therapy, intensively therapy, because you need to break that cycle. Because the spinal cord stimulator is just numbing your feelings about it, but the process is still there. You need to stop that short circuit. And in this case, we're able to, and then finally we were able to slowly start taking the spinal cord stimulator off, and eventually he was completely healed. That for me was a complex regional pain syndrome that was healed. And amazingly enough, it was a spinal cord stimulator, but everything was tried first. But I also have seen patients with a complex regional pain syndrome that doesn't need a spinal cord stimulator, just the aggressive treatment and hard work, and eventually they get better.
Those are great examples. I think you made a really good point there. We have some great treatments that are unfortunately overutilized in some respects, but in the right circumstance, they can make a huge difference and help people get their life back on track.
Fernando, thank you for joining us today and tackling this difficult discussion on complex regional pain syndrome. We at MEC Connect hope that this podcast has made a positive difference in your day. Thank you, and please continue to join us for future episodes of MEC Connect.